When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Kincaid's the leader of the soccer three.
No, there is no bigger soccer fan than the great Kevin Kincaid. We got to get him on the show.
He should work for the MLS.
He really should.
He really should.
He should run the MLS.
I agree.
Yes, very good. Thank you to Tony Bruno and Harry Mays and Ryan Rothstein and especially Phil Collins for that wonderful introduction to the Always Soccer in Philadelphia podcast. We haven't done one in 2 weeks because the truth is that I was sick. The whole family was sick, and I'm getting over it now. I feel better. If I sound nasally, I apologize. But this is our safe space. As you well know, I'm escaping the Ben Simmons circus for 30 minutes, for 40 minutes, hopefully on a Thursday. And escaping the circus with me is a good friend of the program, Joe Tanzi from The Gambler. What's up, man?
What's going on? I think we're all kind of escaping it. This is a very safe space right now.
I want to put myself in a bubble. I want to put myself in a hermetically sealed bubble like Pauly Shore from the Biodome. And I don't want to hear about Ben Simmons for 40 minutes. And then I got to go back to you.
I want to do like the Ted Williams cryo freeze for like, you know, the next week, the weekend. Yeah. We can get over it. Maybe for the playoff series, that's inevitable.
Yeah. I want to do Austin Powers. I want to be cryogenically frozen. And then I want to wake up later and then talk about the carnies. They smell like cabbage, small hands like Kenny Pickett. That's a deep reference. I don't know how many Austin Powers fans we have here. I don't know how many people realize. I realize as I get older, the more like half-baked and Austin Powers references I do, the fewer people know exactly what the hell I'm talking about.
It's okay. I did something. Was it Jameer Nelson Jr. is in the NCAA tournament, and I referenced the St. Joe's team, and I'm like, wait a second. People that are in college right now like don't even remember like. Like Delonte West is like a homeless guy with like a problem.
Yeah.
Delonte West was like him and Jameer Nelson were like unstoppable for
the Jameer Nelson Delonte West team was when I was a freshman in college. Yeah. It feels like it was like, and that was 2004, 2006. I mean, what was that? Like 18 years ago, 17 years ago or something. Insane. Listen, I could talk college basketball with Joe Tanzi all day long, but we're as a Philadelphia Union podcast. And it's time to get onto the important topics. We actually have games to talk about. I did like two podcasts before the season opener. I haven't done a podcast since we played two games. So let's do a quick recap on Minnesota. We'll talk Montreal. We'll go over some of the stuff Jim talked about in the press conference Thursday today, which wrapped up about 10 minutes ago or whatever. Listen, Minnesota, I'm not surprised. 1-1. Okay. You know, the defense, they looked shaky to start. It looked like it was the first game of the season. On that goal that they gave up, the rotations were off. Olivia and Baizo made a mistake. They got a very greasy Philadelphia Union type of goal to equalize. Recycled set piece. They hemmed them in there. They had Jacob Glesnes deliver a fantastic ball into the box. Corey Burke got in there and scored. And, you know, considering the circumstances and the way they played, 1-1, I think, is okay. You would prefer to have the 3 points at home and then get your 1 point on the road, but they did it backwards. So that was my take. I wasn't really surprised. I think the defense will get it back together. And they did in the Montreal game. So lingering final thoughts on Minnesota, Joe.
I think the biggest thing for me in that game was how are they going to deal with the Jameer Montero absence, not attacking wise, but defending wise. I think the right back thing, it is what it is at this point, but, and with Baizo, I think it's not just point to the Eastern Conference final. This isn't like he made two mistakes and Curtin's benched him. It's a series of events and Nate Harriel's done a good job taking over. But I'm very interested to see in the coming weeks how that pocket of space in front of the center backs cleans up, because I think the biggest takeaway for me, at least one of them from Minnesota, was Jose was working his tail off. There's no doubt about that. But there were there were some instances where you could tell he was kind of maybe overcompensating for, you know, what was there in the past with Jamiro being that tough ball winner at the eight. And I think that, again, I think all these criticisms kind of come with time and come with adjustments, which if you're a Union fan and the biggest weaknesses right now are little tweaks, you have to like where you're at.
They were very gappy in that game. You know, Danny pointed this out on the broadcast, like the spacing between the back line and the midfield seemed like it was off. So that's something they definitely have to correct. They got it a little bit better, I think, in the Montreal game. I will say, for as bad as that mistake was that Mbaizo made, and Glesnes too, deciding to hesitate and not charge down the ball carrier, Jack Elliott getting lost with his guy as well, and Kai Wagner falling asleep on the back post. It was kind of all their fault. Obviously, Mbaizo puts him in the compromising position in the first place and forces the rotation from everybody else. But we're going to exercise the Ray Gattis rule on the Always Soccer in Philadelphia program, where when we say something negative about somebody, we try to say something positive if the situation will allow it. And I have to say that when they scored that equalizer, Emmanuel Reynoso got on the ball. He was dicking around on the ball, didn't clear it out of there, tried to back heel. But that's because Olivier was right up on his back. And then Leon Flock cleaned it up, recycled it, and put it back. And they got it back into the mixer, and they scored the goal off that. Like, they scored another sloppy goal in the Montreal game. And like, nobody should be surprised by that. Like, they're probably going to get like one of those per game. You know, that's what they are. They're going to grind out, get these greasy Philadelphia Flyers types of goals where you just throw some bullshit at the net. You put a bunch of bodies up there, you outwork them, you out hustle them. It's like, it's what we call like an effort goal. You know, it's like really nothing crazy, but I do give Olivier credit for helping make that happen by denying that exit in the first place. So I think the reality, Joe, is like, it's probably going to be a lot of, until they kind of get it clicking, probably going to see a lot of those like ugly kind of sloppy goals that we saw last year, right?
To keep with the theme of this week's opponent, I think their Wando goals, is probably the best. I also did a Quakes podcast, so I'm very much into Quakes references this week.
Yeah.
Mentioned that I was limited to one Alan Gordon reference per podcast.
Oh, there you go.
Matt DeGeorge will kill me if I say that repeatedly, but. But yeah, look, I think the fun, finesse, really smooth transition goals are going to come later in the season. Look, it's unfortunate that the striker pairing that they've signed to be this 1-2 punch won't play together until at least next week. And then next week's on a baseball field. And then the week after that's the international break.
Yeah.
So you're not going to see Nakelua and Julian Carranza really click together until April. I think that's the Charlotte game, which I would tremble in my boots if I were Charlotte, if that's the case. but yeah, I mean, it's incomplete. I think I've said this about 10 times, in MLS, you know who the bad teams are right away. The good teams take time to develop.
Yeah.
Some of them are playing CCL. I think Jim Curtin said today, you won't know until the first 10 to 12 games what you have. I think we know what the Union have. It just needs to be out there as all the pieces to the puzzle need to be out there at once. And we're not going to see that until April.
You know, Montreal, the big topic, obviously, was benching Mbaizo. And, you know, at the time I said, like, it's not unjustified. You know, he made a big mistake in the season opener. He made two big mistakes in the playoff game last year when he was the only starter on that back line. The rest were all second unit guys, you know. So if you look at continuity, if you're one of those people who says, like, you know, form can carry it, like, we're going to pay attention to what happened last year and kind of make this a continuation thing. Like, you could say that it's a trend or it's a pattern with him. I thought Harriel looked pretty good, actually. He did a good job on Lapalainen early on. And the goal that they scored was bullshit. Like, the wicked deflection, like, we all know what's going to happen. I would point out, actually, on that one that, you know, when Jack Elliott kind of got sucked in, it was a really good turn by Kone, I think. Jacob Glesnes got moved out of position by another guy. Actually, Harriel came over and he made the right play because he abandoned his guy and he came over to the danger guy, the threat with the ball. Then he forced that pass over to the side and he gets back over, scrambles back over to his original guy, and then the deflection comes off. So I think everybody knows that. I don't think I'm saying anything profound or anything that people don't know here, but he does deserve credit for playing that properly. And it just ended up being unfortunate the way it worked out. So I thought Harry was good. I would like to see him start again. What say you on that topic?
So, yeah, I actually did a kind of a dive into the deep numbers on Sunday. And everything is in favor of Ariel starting again, whether it be duels, passing, tackle, you know, whichever defensive stat or distribution stat you want to use, he outplayed Bizo in those categories. Now, look, you can say different matchups, different demands on the road versus at home, but he definitely didn't do anything to give the job right back to Olivier. That's for sure.
No.
And I think that's, if you're Jim Curtin, you have to go with the guy that you can trust. And man, San Jose, I have no idea what San Jose is actually going to look like in the cold and what 20 degree weather and with man marking going all over the place. I mean, that could get really ugly, really fast. And I mean, maybe you bring in Bizo to, again, to be like the defensive cleaner, cleanup guy.
Yeah.
In the 70th minute. But yeah, I mean, Ariel, that's kind of a long-winded way of saying Ariel should start. And it's crazy that Jim Curtin's actually done this. I don't want to say unprecedented for game two, but it.
But it Jim of 4 or 5 years ago would not have done that. Yeah.
No, and it goes back to the Ray Gattis complex with that. Also, it's the Chris Pontius rule where he would just the drop off between seasons, and everybody would argue on Twitter like, well, why is Chris Pontius still starting on the wing? He has 2 goals.
Well, and even those are midfielders and forwards. Like Jim hates to change anything on the back line ever.
Yeah,
you know? like let alone like a form kind of thing. So to me, there was like a, you know, an extra layer to all that. I would actually make a weird kind of like parallel here or analogy in terms of the Ariel and Bizo thing right now. You know, when you watch like a UFC title fight and it goes the distance and it's a decision and the challenger loses and the champion retains the belt and the challenger says like, well, I think I did enough to win, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not really about doing enough to win. It's like, you got to kind of convincingly like take the belt, you know, like if it's close, like it's probably not going your way, you know? So in a way I see Ariel and Bizo being one of those things where like, I didn't see anything in that game that felt like they were like separated by much at all, you know, to make like any kind of compelling argument that like, hey, I think one is clearly better than the other right now. So in my mind, I go with the default then. And the default is that Ariel was the starter. And, you know, he can continue to start for now. And Bizo came in and fell asleep again on the back post there. So there was, may have been an opportunity for there to kind of like him to like reclaim his confidence, throw him right back on the field. Hey, here's a chance to prove something. And he didn't prove anything. I know it's a tough situation to come on and play like right wing back in a back five when you're down a man. But again, it was kind of, you know, symptomatic, the same thing that had been plaguing him before. He was just kind of falling asleep and losing his marks back there, you know? So to me, when I saw that, I was like, you know, Harry's got to be the guy going forward until Olivier has some kind of opportunity to, or does something in practice to kind of prove otherwise that what we're saying is not valid, you know?
Do you think him being at the AFCON and not playing a ton has something to do with it too?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's just like those guys go back and forth and back and forth. They're playing different styles, different systems. You know, they're trying to stay consistent with logging a lot of minutes. I mean, you know how hard it is to like fly around the world and like have your legs under you and stuff like that. I don't, you know, it's definitely hard. I just think the thing with Olivier is like, nobody's asking him to change anything that requires like years of training. He's not Ben Simmons trying to develop a jump shot. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like we've seen him at his best be a really, really good player. I mean, he's friggin' like AFCON, like quality player. You know what I mean? So it's not anything mechanically wrong with him. It's not technique or skill or anything like that. It's like, there's this alarm that needs to go off in his brain, because I think Olivier is a very like languid, kind of relaxed kind of player who likes to find a groove and like get into the flow of the game. And sometimes like the, you know, your head needs to go, hey, DEFCON 1, like emergency, just hack the shit out of this ball and kick it out of bounds, you know? And so it's not about changing anything in his game. It's about just like flipping that switch in his brain to say, hey, when you see danger, just recognize it and get it out of here. You know
what that reminds me of a little bit? It's probably the extreme level, but Derek Jones, like it was all like, and this is way extreme. I'm not saying Baezo is anywhere close to that, but like where like you knew the physical was there, the something wasn't computing. I think he just got traded again.
Yeah.
he's on his like fifth team, and for like you knew the talent's there, you know the skill set's there, but something's not clicking right now. And I part of it to me is I think he maybe had what, a week and a half, if that, with the Union before the opener. He didn't play much with Cameroon at AFCON. I assume that's got to do something to a player's confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that is just the thing where we know he's a solid player. I'm not saying he's, you know, Derek Jones in any way, but I think from a mental standpoint, it's like, okay, you just got to put the errors past you. Maybe this is the wake up call.
Yeah.
And maybe just the gaining the fitness within the system again, because of the I guess the advantage the Harrell had of just being with the team all winter long.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just something as simple as that with Baezo. But I mean, I would definitely at least the next two games, as long as Harrell doesn't do anything catastrophically bad against San Jose, at least to the international break, let Harry will prove what he can do.
Nathan and Ray, for sure, they both kind of played with like a sense of urgency where it's like, hey, I understand the brevity of the situation around me. I got a guy bearing down on me. I'm facing my own goal. Like, hey, I'm just going to head this ball out of bounds, you know, where mm-hmm. I think, you know, Olivier is much more of a smooth player who wants to take things in stride. And sometimes, you know, sometimes he's like, he's always in like third gear all the time. But like, sometimes you need to like have a heightened awareness to say, oh, I got to get into fourth gear on the sprint back. I need to just hook this ball out of here or something like that. You know, I do think there's, you know, like you look at the way that Ray and Nathan played versus the way that Olivier plays. It's, I mean, Olivier's game is a much more smooth, like forward flowing kind of game where I think when he goes back, sometimes you got to like have a different mindset, like, hey, get this fucking ball out of here. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I there was a lot of questions that people asked when I asked for submissions today about like, hey, you know, when they went down a man against Montreal, you know, why bring him in and do the back five like that versus, you know, and I asked about this and Todd, I think, who asked about it on the call today with Jim on Thursday, was, hey, what's the difference between, you know, throwing Olivier on the outside of Nathan and playing like that back four, back five, like wing backish kind of look versus bringing Stuart Finley on and then kind of pushing them out and having Nathan play like right wing back. And then you have your three center backs there, right? You listened to the answer. It was very in-depth. It was a good answer from Jim. But basically, he just said that they felt like Montreal attacks more down the flanks. We want our 1v1 space defenders out there. He felt like Olivier was a better choice for that versus like Stuart Finley, you know, Kai Wagner pushing forward and Stuart Finley kind of getting like exposed in space and having to like go out to the touchline to defend. Right. Like knowing that and hearing what Jim said, that makes sense to you.
Yeah. And look, I love when tactical Jim comes out. I know he says it sometimes when he prefaces the answers, like, you know, it's going to be long winded and kind of nerdy, but it actually gives you a really kind of detailed insight into what the decision-making process was. And, you know, he talked about basically with the way Montreal played, to give the layman's version, the way Montreal played just didn't suit three center backs.
Mm-hmm.
It suited bringing Baezo on and keeping the shape in the back four. And I love it when coaches are able to go into like that much depth and detail about just one decision like that, because it shines a light and it saves a lot of arguing in the Twitter mentions for sure.
I wish
explanation. Yeah.
I wish other coaches from other teams would understand that. Cause you can quell all this bullshit by just giving an explanation. Jim didn't give out any secrets, you know?
No. And I think that's what a lot of coaches get afraid of, right? They're like, oh, we're going to give away like tactical secrets, you know, or you're not giving away the nuclear codes.
No.
Yeah. No. You're just, and the game already happened. So it's, yeah, I wish a lot more coaches were that in depth and detail, because it does shine a light on, okay, well, we talked about Stuart Finley versus Olivier Baezo and ended up that after long discussion, that's what happened. I think it was really good for him to shine a light on that.
Did, you know, it was interesting because Jim said, you know, normally we go 4-4-1 you know, we go down a man. Most teams go 4-4-1 and they sit in blocks of two, right? But, you know, last year they played, they did leave a second striker on. It was the New York game. Do you remember when, like, John Tolkien was, like, rolled off the field or something and they had a throw in and they got Sergio to score? Yeah, when they were down a man, they scored down
a man. That was the Matt Freeze red card game, right?
Yes, that was the Matt Freeze red card game. And, you know, I was watching this Montreal game last week and it looked like originally I'm like, is Olivier playing like right midfield here? It looks like he was playing like right mid and like the diamond. It looked like they were playing like a flat back four, like a diamond midfield, and then just having Orr up there running around. But I think as they kind of sat back a little bit and Montreal kept pushing forward and pushing forward, it looked more like a back five because that's where they were attacking from. But it looked like you kind of had a triangle there, almost like Bedoya and I think Leon and Brujo Martinez in there. So it's just kind of interesting from that standpoint. But I appreciate Jim being being thorough with that because it helps us answer some questions, you know.
For sure. And then to hit on that real quick, I mean, yeah, watching that formation and the opposite side, the attacking side, to see Mikhail it's a really tough situation to put in because it's his club debut. But I mean, I was impressed with just the physical look. I know you want to ideally make one of those two chances, but physically, I mean, there was one battle where I think either his shirt was tugged or the defender's shirt was tugged and he's going in, he's not afraid to go 1v1. And I think that's going to be a major asset going forward. And maybe you see it this week where, you know, he possibly drops further back and you run Santos in between the defenders.
Yeah.
But I know we're not going to see it for a few weeks, at least on an actual soccer field, but that striker pairing, it has me very intrigued because Carranza's done enough to be like, okay, I know how he fits in this lineup. And the 25-minute cameo we got from Mikel on last Saturday was enough to intrigue me. And that's, you know, that's enough sometimes.
Are you starting or with Burke or with Sergio on Saturday?
Just because it's 25 degrees and I want Sergio's hamstrings to pop.
Yeah.
Go Burke.
Yeah.
I think, man, if they play it right, you bring Sergio on in like the 55th or the 60th and you just tire the hell out of San Jose. I think that's the way to do it.
He just does so much. He is able to do something off the bench that other guys aren't able to do off the bench. If Corey is more like the bulldozer, grind it out kind of guy. It actually would have been a perfect Corey game in Montreal because the shit turf with the ball bouncing and all the aerial
and
stuff. By the way, let me just on a quick A side here. The Big O is an embarrassment. That turf is dog shit. That's the kind of turf like that Andy Reid and Brian Billick would have said, hey, this turf is worse than the Lincoln Financial Field turf that we decided not to play on in the preseason 20 years ago or whatever, you know. That's how bad it is. You can see the seams on TV. You can tell how flat it is from when they had some of those like lower angles or whatever. The turf at YSC is better. The turf at the South Philly Supersite is better. Like nobody should ever have to. The ironic thing too is that, the Big O and Stade Saputo are right across the street from one another.
They're literally right next to each other.
They literally are right now. You and I could walk there in like 2 minutes. So I know the ground is frozen. I know it was like 32 degrees up there. It's not ideal, but like it's ridiculous to me that they have to play in that 1970s stadium. People sometimes get sick. They're like, oh, Kincaid's complaining about the turf again. But like, dude, I'm playing on turf my entire life. I can feel it, dude. I can feel my right knee, like this bump on my knee is fucking sore every time I play on turf, even good turf. Versus like playing on grass, which we haven't been able to do consistently around here, unless you live in the suburbs. You know, like if you play like Casa League or in the city or whatever, you're playing like pretty much South Philly Supersite, you're playing Chestnut Hill, you're playing all these different like areas in North Philly where you don't have anything else to play on but turf. Like you play on turf for 10 years versus playing in grass in 10 years, you're going to notice a difference, you know, in your joints and your knees and your ankles. Like it's just different, you know?
Yeah, I'm not the relative Montreal expert on the Union beat, but I do know you could probably play that game in the cold. I mean, what Saturday's forecast? What, 25 and brutal?
Yeah.
I don't even know. I see wind, I see cold, I see rain. It's all the worst types of weather. And they're playing in here. Like, heck, they just played in however many below Fahrenheit in Minnesota.
Santos Laguna goes up to the Big O and they get their ass kicked. Pumas was playing in the snow at Gillette on the turf last night, got their ass kicked. You know, who got their ass kicked by Seattle? The other, I guess, Club León, you know? So it's like, you know, these conditions are like just not just for like the Mexican teams who've never played in it before, but even other MLS teams going up and do it. It's like, it's the, still to me, like the big question of the league, the macro level question, like, hey, getting off the turf, you know, getting like consistent surfaces here, you know, not having to go from venue to venue in February. But let me break down one more thing from the Montreal game. The goal that the Union scored, the game winner, actually really good recognition by Kai Wagner, because he wasn't, they didn't have any width in the first half. I'm like, where is like Wagner? Normally he did, by this point, he's pumped in like 15 crosses on the left side, you know? It's almost like he was hanging back. I wonder if he was coached to do that. I wonder if they saw something tactically with the way that Montreal plays and they're kind of weird, like three, four, one-ish, two, one-ish kind of system that they have, or maybe it's because, hey, Harriel's on the other side. Hey, let's like stick back and just try to be a little bit more conservative here. But Montreal's back line was a little bit off. Carranza sees that. Wagner sees that. He just floats a ball, you know, hits it with the side, not the side of his foot, but he hits it, hits across the ball, hits it flush, just kind of puts some backspin on it, floats it right into Carranza, and Camacho's up, Johnston is up. And so Gajdog sees that and he says, oh, they're back now. Like, if I make this late run, if I start this run now, like, they're going to have to go away to follow me, you know? So the key to that goal, I think, was just recognition. You know, if I can pick one word for recognition, like understanding where the space is, saying, hey, the Montreal backline, they're playing up pretty far, but they're a little staggered. Let me try to slice into the corner here. We'll dink a ball into the channel. Then I'm going to make this run on the backside. And that's where it was. I was a little surprised Gajdog took that first touch. I'm like, oh shit, he's going to like waffle it here, you know, but smooth finish at the end of the day. It was good to see him get going, you know?
Yeah. I think Gajdog's, recognition, spatial awareness, whatever you want to call it. When Carranza latches onto that pass, that's a run that certain people on this team in previous years maybe don't make.
Yeah,
and I mean, you even saw it in week one. I think there was a chance where Gajdog crossed the ball into the box. I think the closest guy was like Corey Burke, 20 yards from goal, and it was a terrific cross into the they were attacking the non-river end side, so I believe it was in the second half.
Yeah,
but just little things like that, just picking it up and reading, okay, the striker's drifting out to the left, somebody has to fill the space inside the box, I think was very astute on his end. And I mean, that's the reason why the goal happened. You know, Carranza, you know, maybe he gets a little 1v1 battle on the left wing and maybe dinks it out for a corner if that run isn't made. But
yeah, you can like, this isn't like a hot take or necessarily anything new. I just don't think that people really think of it this way. Normally when we talk about ball watching, we talk about like a defender who's just like snoozing, right? But you can ball watch on offense too. You know, like if somebody rips an amazing shot and you're like, oh shit, that's a great shot. And then a rebound comes and you're not like reacting to it. That's ball watching. Gajdog, you know, if he sees that beautiful chip over the top and the beautiful first touch with from Carranza with his chest, he could sit there and say, oh man, what a touch. But, you know, instead he's saying, oh, I know this guy who's on me is out of position now because he dragged that center back out and the other guy's pushed forward. Let me get in here now. Like, let me identify that space and let me go now. It's like ball watching can happen at any portion of the field. You know, it's just about kind of like the understanding of like, hey, I got to move and I got to move now. So it was good to see that from him. I still don't really know what kind of 10 Gajdog is. He's got a little bit of Barnetta in his game without like the volume touches portion of it. He seems kind of like a utility knife kind of guy, but if they can get him going, you know, then it's you
know. I mean the majority, I want to say what, 75-80% of the goals are going to come from that attacking trio.
Yeah.
Just because of what's behind them. So how do you create not only assists but goals? So I think that was a promising sign. You're right. I think it's kind of incomplete on what he's going to bring, because second half addition in MLS, I mean, you know how this goes. You're lucky if these guys contribute like three to five goals, because the transition's so hard. And I mean, the guy played what, 60 games last year.
Yeah.
So at some point those legs have to be tired in certain stretches of games. So yeah, I'm very intrigued. I'll say that. There's enough there from the first two games to say, okay, whenever this gets together, which is going to be at Yankee Stadium, so really a real soccer field in April, there's definitely some promise there. I think, Jim's compared Carranza to Tati Castellanos in the way he works on both ways of the field. So that comparison obviously intrigues you because Castellanos is going to be sold for buku bucks at some point. whenever New York City says yes, finally to that, it's not like they need a ton of money they're holding out for. And then, everything with Makoa sounds like he's going to be a guy. I think you have to, I know it's kind of a lazy comparison, but Hani Mukhtar just came from the same club and almost the MVP.
Yeah.
So you have to think of that. And then if those two get together and have a functional 10 behind them, there's a lot to get excited about if you really break down the potential of these guys.
Let's just do a little bit more here. I'm just going to rifle through some questions. Most of the stuff, I actually went through the questions earlier, and most of the stuff we kind of touched on in the discussion already. Where's the one I wanted to find here? Oh, this is from PHL and me, Hooper512. He says, this is actually a comment, not a question. He says, I bet field questions probably come up. I live in Maine, and the ground here in March is in one of two conditions. It's either frozen solid or it's pure mud. Montreal is probably still frozen, right? And he says, the question is why home games are scheduled in Montreal so early. Thanks. Great stuff, especially the Jim and Danny episodes. Yeah, no problem, man. Yeah, it's interesting because I've been up to Maine a couple times. I actually love Maine. Maine is actually very underrated. Portland is a cool town. Bangor didn't have much there, but it was like cool, some cool breweries and stuff. But yeah, I guess it's just like, even if it's like 32 degrees at Stade Saputo that day and it's right across the street, I mean, the condition of the field is probably dog shit, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, there's so many advances you can make in field technology now.
Yeah.
That you would think just in some capacity, they would have something to keep the field heated, or at least just, have Montreal play all the Texas teams. CCL this year anyway, so just shove them down there.
There's so many games in the season, is so long. Like, to me, it's ridiculous that we have to even start in February to begin with. Like, I don't think that has to be a thing. Like, if you look at the difference just in temperatures from like the two weeks between like that late February and like the middle of March, like it does make a difference if they can just shave those two weeks off of it. I just wish they had a different, I don't know what the answer is, I just wish they had a better way to do it.
I mean, there's spring doesn't exist as a season in the Northeast. It goes, spring is when your first local Rita's opens and that's really it.
For me, it's winter. It's miserable winter. Then like one terrible week of allergies and then 89 degrees.
There's an 80 degree week in like the end of March. You're like, oh, well, I guess we just bypass spring. Rita's is open. Let's just, windows down. It's short season.
Here's a question from Frankie. He says, would Paxton make sense as a Carranza replacement with Orr on Saturday? The answer is no, because I don't think Paxton is a second forward. I don't think he's a striker. No. But the second part of what Frankie's saying is, can you do Christmas tree with Orr alone? Because I feel like his skill set pairs better. Or never mind, that part's not relevant. But based on the limited whatever I saw from Michael Orr, he very much does look like a guy who can play as a lone striker. So if they wanted to do, I remember, like, people got to remember in the Christmas tree, like, Kasper Schibilka was slower than molasses, right? I love Kasper. Yeah. He did a lot of great things, scored a lot of big goals. Stretching a team is not like something he could do. Those chances that Orr carved out the other day, Schibilka would have never even been close to doing that. Like, are you kidding me? Like, running into the channel and then like angling towards goal. Kasper never would have been able to do that. So to me, if they did want to drop a second striker and they did want to go back to Christmas tree and they did want to play Paxton up there, they did want to play Jack McGlynn up there and add a midfielder in exchange for one of the strikers, based on what I saw from Orr, they can definitely do that if they want to go back to that.
Yeah, I think they can. I just think you got to put enough pace against San Jose if they're going to do this man-marking nonsense and I mean, Francisco Calvo is their starting center back.
Yeah.
I think that's all you need to know about what they, where they stand. I mean, I watched them play the Red Bulls week one, and the Red Bulls looked like a team that could win the Eastern Conference. And I don't rate the Red Bulls much yet. I think they're definitely in the tier below the Union in the East. And then, I mean, Columbus kind of ripped them apart a little bit too. Part of it was Ziller Ryan being a magician, but
yeah,
I think you need to exploit Francisco Calvo as much as you can. And I think, if I remember correctly, Corey Burke did that against Chicago last year. So maybe it is a Corey Burke game, because I believe he did have a good amount of success as the second striker last year against Chicago with Calvo in there.
There was a question in here about, this is kind of heavy, I don't want to get too deep into this, but somebody was asking, like, hey, FIFA was talking about letting Russian players out of their contracts because of the conflict that's going, it's not a conflict, it's a fucking ridiculous, illegal, ridiculous war going on over there. They were saying that they might allow Russian players out of their contracts. And he says, are there any Russian players that you would like or that you would go after? And the answer is, like, absolutely. Like,
yeah,
Smolov from Lokomotiv for sure. A lot of those Zenit guys are really good. I think, well, he wouldn't come over here, but their best player right now is probably the guy Golovin, who plays for Monaco. And they have a guy who plays for Atalanta now. But that's fascinating too. I just, you know, I feel like this is a topic that's mm-hmm. that's much more important than just a quick throw in at the end of this podcast or whatever.
Yeah, and I think what the players from the Ukrainian clubs too, they said they would release. I mean, I leave all my my transfer scouting and whatnot to Union Hulk, because he's so effective with his recruiting strategies.
Yeah.
But I look at some of those names and I see Brazilians and I see, I mean, from a pure soccer standpoint, you at least have to maybe inquire.
Well, listen, man. I mean, like, look, Ilsenio just retired. I can't believe I didn't even say anything about that. Maybe we'll get
proper tribute. He came from Shakhtar Donetsk.
Right?
So, he played there.
Like you got to be thinking to yourself, like, hey, you know, like, you guys are in the middle of this shit, because Donetsk is in the region where the Russian separatist bullshit was going on in the first place, right? Like, yo, come to Philadelphia, like, get your family out of there. You'll be like 100% safe and accepted. Ilsenio played for you guys, he played for us, he can be an ambassador for it. Like, it would be great if you know, MLS or any other teams in general would be able to, you know, provide a home for these guys mm-hmm. if this shit keeps going on and on and on, and that league is like suspended, because there's really good players who play for Shakhtar Donetsk and Dynamo Kiev and like what's the one for Kharkiv, Metalist
or yeah,
like
yeah,
you know, even like those Dnipro teams, I don't think they're even a club anymore, but they had like dudes, and that the dudes that they were sending out of Ukraine, like Konoplyanka and Yarmolenko and like Andriy Shevchenko, they got really good players over there and really good Brazilian dudes who play for those teams too. And like, yo, get out of that shit. Bring your families over here. Like, we should open the doors for them to come over and play here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, look, the first and foremost, it's get your families out of there.
Yeah.
Be safe as human beings. But from a soccer business standpoint, if they're getting released from their contracts, if there's a fit, you know, I don't know if the Union have any space for anyone at this point, but I mean, look at the guys who are going to get sold soon. You would think,
yeah,
but there's at least three of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's just like a, you know, I'm pulling up on my phone. I just looked at the Shakhtar, lineup. They always have like really good Brazilian players and stuff. I just think there's like a twofer, like slam dunk, you know, opportunity here for like, you know, MLS to say like, hey, you know, you guys are more than welcome over here. Get your families out of that. You know, there's a mm-hmm. you know, good opportunity to play over here. The level is good. Yeah, like Harmash plays for Dynamo Kiev. The midfielder, what's his name? Bujalski, I think is how you say it. They have good players over there, and it's like, get out of that shit. Come over here, come play for Philly, man. You know,
I mean, how many MLS teams right now could benefit from somebody of that quality?
Like, oh yeah,
90% of them.
Yeah, yeah. They got the guy. I'm trying to. I can't remember. I lost the stupid thing on my phone here. I think it's Sidorchuk or Sergei Sidorchuk. I can't remember how you say his name. I think he's the Dynamo Kiev captain. He's really damn good too. He plays for the national team. They have other guys who play for Benfica, and like Yarmolenko plays for West Ham for sure. But like,
yeah, and they got, was it Malinovsky at Atalanta too?
Yeah, Ruslan Malinovsky.
Yeah.
They got good players, man. I would love for FIFA, MLS, UEFA, anybody just to say, hey, like, this is like a international conflict between countries. Like, we don't know exactly what our place is, but like, let's do our part. Get these guys out of here. Let them come play over here. Continue their careers. Get their families out of there. Let them be safe. You know, so that's the way I see it. You know. Listen, I think that's all we got, man. There was another couple questions in there. I think we talked over most of it though, but yeah, so far so good. Listen, man, I guess you would probably agree with me. Like 4 points out of two games is fine. I thought they were going to do it in reverse order, get the three at home and then get the one up there. But I mean, I guess you can't be upset with the way that they did it, you know?
Yeah. Look, 4 points from two games, you do the whole thing. If I told you 2 weeks ago, that would be the case, you take it. And I guess, you know, you have it. So, I mean, that you can't be disappointed with that. Again, they're an incomplete team at this point just because the two strikers haven't played together.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you have to have at least some promising signs and some hope. It's not like last year where everything's dedicated to CCL and it ends up being, some of these losses are concerning.
All good things. We're going to see more of Michael Orr. Jamiro Matar is not going to be there on Saturday. I want people to message me and tell me your best Ilsinho moments and goals, and we'll do a proper tribute for him on the next podcast. But meantime, Joe Tanzi, thank you, my friend. Always appreciate having you on.
Yeah, I appreciate it. It's been a while. This is a long way from doing the podcast in the corner of a gym in like Medford. So I think the first time I did it was like no cell reception at Shawnee High School before covering a basketball
game. It was pre-pandemic too. Remember, nobody knew what Zoom was. And so I had you on the phone. I was recording. Like, did George hook me up with like a little phone jack that I plug into my pre-Sonus box over here? And I was recording straight into the thing, but this is a lot easier. So appreciate it as always, man. You guys know you listen to Joe on the post-game show too. I'm not going to be on the post-game show on Saturday. I'm actually alternating every other week. Starting now, just because I have too much going on with my two little kids, you know. But Joe,
you actually have a life. I don't have kids yet, so I'm
soon, man. Soon, you're next.
I hope so.
Yeah. Joe's gonna be. You're gonna be on everyone this year, though.
Yeah, and okay. we might, just a heads up, we might have something a little different for you guys on just this Saturday because Villanova might be in the Big East tournament final.
Okay.
So I'll let everyone know, but we might have to do the Twitter spaces pre and post game instead of on air. But that's our only over, that's our only overlap because March is a very busy time of year.
Yeah. All right. No problemo. We'll look for that. Joe, thanks a lot, man. And thank you everybody for listening. It's always soccer in Philadelphia, even when the Ben Simmons bullshit has crested and is coming at you full bore.